Coming up, got Dane Moore breaking down Game 7 of the Thunder and the Nuggets. OKC advancing to face the Minnesota Timberwolves. So then we got into that, talking about all the different layers to watch for in the Western Conference Finals. This week, later in the week, going to have more draft coverage and also going to have an Eastern Conference Finals preview between the Pacers and the Knicks. But today, it's all about the West, all about what's going on for the future of the Nuggets as well, and then a West Conference Finals preview. That's coming up right now with my guest, Dane Moore. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. Well, we got our Western Conference Finals matchup, both of our Conference Finals matchups. Of course, we have the Pacers and the Knicks in the East. And then now we know we have the Minnesota Timberwolves and the Oklahoma City Thunder in the Western Conference. And to discuss it, bringing on Dane Moore from the Dane Moore NBA Show. Dane, how are you doing today, man?
I'm good. I thought we were going to be real serious. You know, we're going to like chop up this super intense Game 7. And then you and I were just texting each other by half the beginning of the third quarter. But I'm ready to go, man. I was locked in on this one because we got Wolves Thunder coming up on Tuesday.
Oh, yeah, baby. I'm excited for the series coming up. Let's talk about the game today, first of all, because Game 7's Sunday afternoon. I'm expecting an amazing down-to-the-wire performance, like you said, and we get a blowout. 125-93 Thunder win. But it started out scary for OKC because the Nuggets, they get up to an 11-point lead early in the first quarter. Aaron Gordon, who allegedly has a grade 2 hamstring strain, out there, heroic effort, making plays for Denver. And I felt like OKC looked scared early. They're bricking shots. They're not moving decisively. But then there were, I thought, three sequences that turned the game towards OKC, Dane. One, first quarter, Nuggets up 11. Westbrook enters the game, gets blocked at the rim, has two turnovers, multiple defensive miscues, and what was a just horrible performance by him. He finished minus 92 plus minus in the series, minus 34 in Game 7. But then start of the second quarter, Nuggets still up 5 at that point. They go without Jamal Murray, without Nikola Jokic, without Michael Porter Jr. I don't think you can go a single second without Murray and Jokic in a Game 7. But then end of the third quarter is really when it all shifted. Final 3 minutes, OKC's up 42-41. They're swarming on defense. Three Denver turnovers in the final 3 minutes of the first half. 18-5 run for OKC. They go up 60-46 at half. And Dane, I thought that sequence sure as hell summed up why OKC had the number one defensive rating by far all season long. Don't you think so as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if the last thing was turnovers, they started turning the ball over, like Denver started turning the ball over like crazy, or I guess Oklahoma City started forcing them to turn the ball over. And that's this team's superpower, man. Like, they don't only turn you over more than anyone else, but they don't turn the ball over themselves. So they are dominating this possession battle every single game. And it's not fair, you know, and it's what allows people like, how does Oklahoma City go on these huge runs? It's that when they get the ball, they score. And when they don't have the ball, they get it back. It's not just a dominant defense, in my opinion. It's the way that they protect it on the other side of the floor as well.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it, Dane, the way they protect the lead as well. And look, man, I think with OKC, their defense in today's game, I have not seen Denver have a harder time making entry passes to Jokic than they did today. Like, okay, I mean, OKC putting small players on Jokic all game, swarming on defense. I thought it was a masterstroke decision by Dagnall because he waited all series long for this. We saw Jokic dominate Game 1, and then OKC changed their defense in Game 2. Drew Hanlon, who is a great skills coach, he works with Chet and Hartenstein. He came on my podcast and described the way they were influencing Jokic to get away from his left shoulder, right-handed finishing, which is what he wants to do. And Jokic struggled until Game 5 and Game 6 when he started to figure things out. And then they make this adjustment in Game 7 to put smalls on Jokic. Now, you have a lot of people on social media saying how they were fouling all game. But what was your take on what OKC decided to do against Jokic in this Game 7?
Yeah, I mean, it's so different than game one, right? When Chet came out on Jokic, it seemed like the game plan more than anything defensively against Jokic was never Chet. You know, they wanted it to be Hartenstein on him. And then it was, then once they took Hartenstein off the floor, it was Caruso or like a little bit of J-Dub. They always wanted Chet to be there as that lurking sort of second defender if he was out there, but never as the primary on Jokic, which reminded me of the Western Conference semis last season of how the Wolves, you know, they guarded Jokic with Kat, and then they had Rudy sort of lurking there. And that was a big reason why they were able to, you know, sort of manage Jokic in that way. It was just, I wasn't expecting it to be Caruso. And that just became like their favorite thing to do in this game was just have Caruso on Jokic, foul him. But you know how it is, man. When it's like a 6'6 guy guarding a 7-foot guy, you get away with more. I guess you could put that on the refs, but I think a lot of that is just strategy, you know?
Yeah.
And Caruso can handle that.
I totally agree. I think it's strategy. Look, these playoffs have been physical start to finish, right? Like, it's been like that in round one. It was like this in round two, and it was like this in this game seven today. It's been physical. OKC knows it's been physical, and they use that to their advantage with the skilled guys that they have on defense. And it's not like they're just outright fouling every single possession. They're playing masterful positioning. Like, I'm crediting Dagnall and that coaching staff for coming up with this game plan and pulling it out, but the players have to execute it. And, right. And like, what plays that comes on my mind, I posted this on social, and it was like Hayson Wallace steal in the third quarter. Like, Jalen Williams was just locking down Jamal Murray on the perimeter, mirroring his every movement, which was a theme all game. And then Jokic came over and set a screen being defended by Caruso, and OKC blitzed Murray really aggressively with Caruso and Williams on the play, like, I'm there, the left wing. And then it's Hayson Wallace's responsibility to rotate over to Jokic, and you could see him on this play just time his steps perfectly to get to Jokic right as soon as Jokic is catching the ball and bringing it down to get into whatever motion he wants to do. And that's when Wallace swipes at it, steals it, leads the break. Caruso finishes on the other end of the floor. And I just thought it was one of many, many, many examples in this game where OKC's players just perfectly executed the game plan and bothered Jokic, bothered Murray, bothered whoever was trying to pass the ball to Jokic. It was just a completely masterful defensive performance. Do you think the Minnesota Timberwolves are watching this like, oh my God, what are we going to do against this?
I think we knew this, man. We knew this, right? Like, I mean, you're talking about Wallace doing that, and you're like, okay, it's like little Wallace who's not afraid of this guy. They haven't been afraid all year, man. They do this the entire season. You turn on a regular season Oklahoma City game, and these guys, it wasn't their first time meeting a guard up a big guy, you know, and because of that, they have a confidence in being able to go to any which lineup combination. Like, I don't know if Dagnall actually was like, this is the game plan, or this is a pivot we can go to, because, you know what, if it wouldn't have been working, and if Jokic just started like crushing Caruso or Wallace wasn't effective, well, then he can go back to Jalen Williams guarding him, who was effective on Jokic before. I mean, it's just, they have this like embarrassment of riches in that specific way of just confident guys who can guard different positions and handle it. So yeah, like, if you're the Wolves, you know, this is the number one thing on the scouting report. It's just like, can you take the advantage when you have the ball and be like, we are controlling the pace of this possession. I have the ball. I'm going to go score on you. When the Thunder are great, it's because their defense seems to be controlling the flow of a possession. You know what I'm saying? Like, and that is not even other really good defenses around the league. That's why Oklahoma City was special this year. You turn them on, it was a different level of like, we are imposing ourselves on you. I don't care if I'm 6'4", Kaysen Wallace, or I'm 6'11", Isaiah Hartenstein. That team imposes. And they don't adjust to you. And that's because I think they set that pattern, not just this season, but that's been the culture there for, you know, years now. That's why they're great.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is, like, as you're talking about OKC and what they've built, I'm a little surprised they're so hated on social media. Like, I feel like every group chat I'm in, everything I see on social is like anti-OKC. And I'm like,
Kevin, let me ask you, what do they like? What do people like then? Nobody likes anything. what is your friend saying in the group? As, you know, I don't know. Like, show me the positive stuff. What, sure. What, like, sure. Seriously.
Nobody likes anything.
Pacers suck. Knicks are terrible. Wolves are a joke. It's only because Steph was out. Like, get that. The OKC flops. Nobody likes any team anymore, I'm convinced.
But why? Like, OKC organically built. They're not some like fast built super team. They have drafted basically everybody except for the pieces around the edges they got with Hartenstein and Caruso that they added last year to improve some of the flaws that they had last year in their second round loss. And those guys showed up big time today and throughout this series, especially Caruso in this game seven. And everybody else, besides SGA with the Paul George trade, of course, he's their best player. But like, this whole roster is organically built. Young guys they acquired, like SGA, perfectly savvy veterans that they acquired at a good price. They were smart to go acquire those guys, and they paid for Caruso with Giddy. That wasn't an easy deal to make, as young as Giddy is. And then basically everybody else, they've drafted or undrafted guys. I just fail to see why people dislike this OKC team or the Minnesota team that they're going to go up against. But I do think people are going to be rooting for Minnesota next round against OKC. That is what I think we're going to see next round.
You think people are going to be rooting for the team with Julius Randle and Rudy Gobert on it?
Okay, maybe people are going to root for them both to lose.
I don't know.
Maybe that's what we're going to see.
I don't know. I haven't seen a single positive thing out there, whatever. And I don't think any of these guys care. I know the Wolves don't care. And I certainly don't get the sense that the Thunder care either. They're like, let's go. Like, whatever it is, whoever it is, whatever you're saying, like, I think OKC knows who they are. And I think Indiana really does too. And I think Minnesota and New York are like a couple close adjustments away from like really understanding who they are, and that's what's
Minnesota
that's
missing?
What's driving though? Success?
What's Minnesota like? What's the difference there with Minnesota not understanding fully who they are?
Well, I think they just met themselves in the playoffs with Julius Randle. This Julius Randle, like, this has been the vision for Chris Finch from the beginning of the season, that Julius Randle was going to not only be an effective secondary option, but in fact, like, a substantially more offensively impactful second option than Karl Anthony Towns was. And, you know, people wrestled with that all year. I came on here and you were like, Naz Reid, like, get Julius Randle hell out of here. Like, that,
bring him
know,
off
that
the bench. Randle could bruise right. people off the bench. Instead, he's doing it as a starter in the postseason.
Yeah, I remember what you said. No, but like, they did it. It made sense. And I'm joking. Like, I was saying the same thing over the course of the season as well, because the Wolves were trying to like force this identity upon themselves, and they finally like feel like they've come to it, feel natural that this is Julius is the guy when Ant isn't going, and they understand the best ways to activate Julius. And I think, so yeah, you can make the argument that the Wolves do now know who they are. I'm just like, it was a couple weeks ago, man, that like this would offensively felt funky a lot of the time. And if they weren't playing as good of a defensive team in Oklahoma City, I'd be like, all right, yeah, I'm pretty sure the Wolves can dictate here offensively. But that's going to be the battleground, right? The Wolves perimeter creators versus the Thunder's perimeter defenders trying to generate those turnovers and go on those runs that we saw, you know, today.
Based off of what we've seen from Minnesota through the first two rounds, what's your level of confidence in Anthony Edwards, Julius Randle, et cetera, to be able to effectively create against Oklahoma City in the West Finals?
Yeah, well, how do you think they're going to guard Ant? That's where I think this all starts. Is, you know, are you putting two on the ball on him, and you know, now you're trying to get the ball out of his hands, and now you got to kind of play through Rudy on the short roll or whoever the screener is on the short roll? Is that how they're going to try and limit him? In the first two rounds, you know, and historically in the playoffs, Phoenix as well last year, they've just been loading up like real tight shells. Like, the Lakers were really packed into the paint against Ant. Gap help on the left, gap help on the right, but not like pure double teams. And I think Oklahoma City is going to be more of that version of really protecting the shell of the paint and not letting Ant get in there, but not necessarily blitzing Ant to get the ball out of his hands. And Ant's going to need to navigate that. And frankly, he's going to need to navigate that better than he did the first couple rounds, because the level of defenders, I mean, it's very different if it's Lu Dort than Brandon Podziemski or Austin Reeves. You know what I'm saying? Like, if they're going to pack it in tight there, Ant is going to need to find his way to find crevices to be able to spray the ball out to other shooters or to Julius to create himself. But that's going to be a challenge for Ant as well. We'll see. I don't know exactly what Oklahoma City is going to bring. That would be my assumption. What do you think there?
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I don't expect them to aggressively blitz. I mean, I mentioned that play in the third quarter earlier when they blitzed Jamal Murray, a very aggressive blitz, basically a trap on the left wing, trying to force the ball out of his hands on the wall of steel that I described earlier. I don't expect to see like hard blitzing slash trapping in the early part of this series, but I'd expect to see a lot of switching. You know, I think you'll see a lot of switching with OKC's defense early in the series, but if it's Hartenstein involved in a pick and roll, maybe he's going to play up the touch in some of those situations. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I think they'd save some of the blitzing for later in the series and kind of trust the switching defense and the amount of versatility they have early on in the series, because a lot might depend also on who they put on Randle. Like, how do you expect OKC to match up against Julius Randle and then against Anthony Edwards with their man-to-man matchups, at least the start possessions?
Yeah, so it's funky. You know, the classic, the regular season matchups were weird. The Wolves played the Thunder three times in the course of four games, and it happened to be when Julius Randle, Dante DiVincenzo, and Rudy Gobert were all out. Chet Holmgren had just come back from injury then. And then the first time they played them, the Wolves were totally healthy, but Chet wasn't playing. So we haven't really seen how Dagnall wants to approach that exactly with this group over the course of the season. We can't point to something specific there. I think, though, you need to prioritize Randle right now, because you know you got Dort to be able to put on Ant. And I don't know if they go with Hartenstein there or if they just say J-Dub guarding him. I think it might just be put J-Dub there and then kind of tuck Chet Holmgren onto Jaden McDaniels would be my guess. But what they're going to also do is, you know, mix it up over the course of the series. I just don't think it's one of those where we know exactly what this is going to look like over the course of the series, which leads me to believe it might be a matchups adjustment sort of series over the course based on what Julius is able to do against whoever they put on him in game one.
I think you're right there. It's going to be something that changes throughout the series. Probably starts with Jalen Williams. That's what I would expect with his size. Yeah. We've seen OKC throughout the season have him often defend some larger players. And Randle's, I mean, obviously a massive load to handle if you're Jalen Williams, but he's shown the toughness. And I think in one of those matchups, if I remember correctly, they had him defending Naz Reid a lot, who, of course, is larger in his own way, just a different type of player than Julius Randle. But J-Dub has handled those matchups a lot. And Lu Dort, I would expect to be the primary guy for OKC against Anthony Edwards. But ultimately, it's going to be a lot of switching, and we're going to see tactical changes when OKC's on defense throughout. On the other end of the floor, with Minnesota on defense and OKC on offense, I do think it's interesting. I don't know if we see Minnesota pull this out, but I do think it's interesting how Denver's zone defense was so effective at turning OKC into the Boston Celtics. Like, you're taking half your shots from three. That's what you're going to do, right? And that can work, but it can also, they can go through cold spells. OKC against the Denver zone entering game seven. I don't have the up-to-date stats. Against Denver's zone, they took over 50% of their shots from three. That was closer to around 40% of their shots from three when Denver was playing to man-to-man. I wonder if maybe we'll see some of that if OKC is generating a lot of quality looks against man-to-man defense. Would you expect Minnesota to possibly pull out zone at all against the Thunder?
Well, that's how they had the 25-point comeback against the Thunder earlier this season. They're down by 25 in the fourth, and they came back to win the game in overtime. It was that strip-mine version of the Wolves, but it was even with Ant wasn't even on the floor in that fourth quarter of that game when they came back. And I mean, it was a 2-3 zone in the sense that there was two guys up top and there was three guys down low, but the two guys up top were elevated to the degree of, you remember when, you know, Harden was in Houston and they would just send a second guy up there right away as soon as he crossed half court? They basically did that to SGA that whole fourth quarter, they were like, all right, well, we're down by, we need to make up 20 points here. We're just going to get it out of his hands and hope that Dort, all those guys just kind of miss threes. And it worked. That is different than what Denver was doing. Because what I felt like Denver's defense did, because it was a little, the zone was a little bit more packed in, was I felt like they were just daring J-Dub to be the guy or somebody else to like puncture a gap, you know? And it was kind of like tilting the zone towards SGA, but condensed in. And I thought it was really smart because it just made it so somebody else had to be the guy that was puncturing the gaps to get to the basket, or the Thunder just have to settle for threes, which they can hit at a high clip, as we saw in the second half and this and that. But it is a gamble if you're going to play zone against them. I do think it's a tactic that you could see periodically, probably more so when the Wolves are down, to try and just catch lightning in a bottle of a bad shooting run from the Thunder, more than it being like, there's no way they're going to run it as much as Denver did. I think they're going to play drop with Rudy, and that kind of feels like a zone sometimes too. Like, not going to give Shea open 15 footers, but like, it's going to be drop coverage and it's going to kind of feel like a condensed zone there. And then the actual zone, if they show it, is going to be more of like a press at half court and coming back. At least that's what it looked like during the regular season.
Do you think the Wolves' brass is crushed by the result of this game seven instead of a injured, hampered, sick Denver team?
I thought you were going to just say from like a Denver perspective. I don't think any of us want to go back to Denver anytime soon. But the Wolves and Nuggets have played each other like 25 times in the last 4 years. Like, we've been to Denver.
You want to go to OKC though? You want to go to OKC though?
I don't want to do that either. No, you're right. No. Denver would have been a significantly better matchup. Yes, they are probably kicking themselves that didn't end up happening there, especially with Gordon out. Denver would have been a better matchup. The Wolves have their strategies against Murray and Porter Jr., and then they just kind of let Rudy try to handle Jokic. I think they would have been more confident about that happening just because they've seen it. I don't think they're not going to be confident against the Thunder. It's just not the advantage. Biggest advantage of Denver is the Wolves would have known right now how they were going to play them. And they would have known exactly how Denver was going to guard them, because they would have blitzed Ant every single time. They would have known exactly what that would look like, and they would know exactly how they were going to guard Denver. So outside of a talent gap between the Nuggets and the Thunder, it's the understanding thing. And that's the biggest thing I'm looking for in game one, is the Wolves, specifically Edwards and Randle's ability to read and understand what this is. Julius Randle's two bad games of the playoffs are game one against the Lakers and game one against the Warriors, because he didn't have the feel of it yet. So they got to be on that to like know what it is that they're going to be doing against them, which is just not as clear right now as it would have been with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a smart point, because Minnesota knows Denver. But with that said, that makes me think about, do you think they spent these last 4 days prepping for OKC? Because they know Denver. They already have their Denver game plan. They finished off the Warriors on Wednesday. I would anticipate Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and today was all about OKC, right?
I was at practice. They said they were waiting. They hadn't done game plan specific stuff. I wasn't there today. I'm sure they were doing stuff today. But we talked to Gobert and Conley and whatever, and they hadn't like specifically gone into that, I guess, waiting for who the opponent was. I think it's just a game plan install that, you know, you put in. They probably put that in today, and they had the two options there readily available. I'm just saying, I don't think they know what Oklahoma City is going to do, because that's Oklahoma City's thing, is they have this versatility to them of how they can play, how they can guard stylistically, as we just saw in game seven against Denver and Jokic.
I think that's true. I mean, like, there's only so much prep you could do against Oklahoma City. That's why they're a 68 win team. That's why, I mean, look, I don't want to rag on Dagnall too much. I don't think this series should have gone seven if it weren't for some of the mistakes he made early in the series. The falling up three when Jokic is off the floor, the weird challenge at the end of, I think, game three, among, I don't want to go through it all, but so many errors early in the series. This could have been a shorter series for OKC is my point. Like, this team is a juggernaut. This just, they went seven against a super experienced Denver team as an inexperienced team that made some mistakes. But now they face Minnesota, been to a West Finals before. They've had a longer run, but they're not necessarily Denver. They haven't won a finals yet. With Anthony Edwards specifically, his growth from last year to this year, for people who maybe haven't watched the Minnesota Timberwolves this season, they're fans of another team. How would you describe how Anthony Edwards has evolved from 1 year ago to where he is now?
It's that he doesn't dunk anywhere near as much as you would think he does if you're just watching highlights on Instagram. Like, that, obviously he can do it and those are cool. But it's kind of like Cat. Cat was always like, oh, best 3-point shooting big man in the league. I'm going to shoot 3 per game though. You know, like that it didn't translate, right? You know, he doesn't shoot a lot of threes. Ant doesn't like get down to the basket and dunk a lot of the time. Ant's superpower has become the 3-point shot and the walk-in three, the finding his three, catch and shoot off the dribble, step back right, step back left. Like, he's as good of a 3-point shooter as anybody in the NBA is right now outside of Steph Curry. And I'm talking about like self-created, probably the second best. I mean, I don't know, right? Wouldn't you say it's right there and he's doing it on volume. He shot 11 threes a game, you know, during the regular season. That's the change in Anthony Edwards. That if you haven't been watching since last year and you're picturing him getting into the middle of the lane and trying to get to his mid-range, like, no, his shot diet is he shoots a lot and he shoots a lot of threes. And they want to create as many of those for him as possible. And then if a gap's there and a defensive breakdown, yeah, then he's going to try and take advantage of that and dunk on you. But a lot of the time, his biggest flaw in this postseason is he's not finishing well at the rim. And if you give him contact at the rim and that the kind that's not called, like, he is not going to finish those at a high clip, despite the fact that you might see him dunk on somebody at some point during the series. It's just that eye test doesn't necessarily match what happens over the course of 100 possessions in a game.
According to Synergy Sports, this postseason, Anthony Edwards is making 47.7% of his total layups in the half court. That drops to only 44.8% of layups in the half court. During the regular season, he was at 52.9% of made layups in the half court. Why
not
the decline?
That's bad. He's not. It is bad. He needs to play to the contact more. And I know that's like getting a little floppier in that, but he tries to finesse his way like with force and then around it, rather than straight through it, you know, like some other guys would, and try to draw the contact there to get to the line. I mean, he'll let you know he thinks he got fouled, but he hasn't totally like crafted the art of the sale yet on some of those. And instead he kind of tries to play around the rim, like the Hartenstein at the rim or whatever it might be, and, you know, finish with finesse. And that's just going to go in at a lower clip than, you know, 2 free throws would in terms of like points per possession.
In other words, you're saying he needs to be disliked like SGA and just start flaring and flopping around.
Yeah. Everybody, we hate everybody here. Everybody likes Ant too much, you know? Yeah, he's the one person that everybody likes. Maybe people will pick this team.
Yeah. No, I mean, exactly. Yeah, now you see where I'm coming from here. Everybody loves Ant. SGA, everybody just thinks he's a grifter and a flopper, which is ridiculous. But also, he does grift and flop sometimes. Because you have to. I see you with your point.
You got to get off X, man. You got to. You got a t-shirt on? What's happening, dude? This is it's a rotting your brain.
I had a zoom out. The logo.
Oh, yeah, sure. Kevin O, X-rated. Yeah.
good nickname there. One other thought here with Minnesota. I get the impression you're not totally confident at the series. Would you be picking the Thunder?
Series? Don't label me like a hater. They won 68 games. The Thunder are really good. I mean, in all seriousness, though, like it's hard. I'm around the team, you know, over the course of this season. You're writing stories, doing podcasts about the things that don't work for a team. And there was a lot of things that didn't work for this team during the regular season. And so those are like more fresh on my mind and fresh in my understanding. But what I've been saying in this postseason is I need to like let some of that go from my mind, because what's happened in these postseasons is a lot of the issues that they've had during the regular season go away in the postseason due to greater focus, greater intention, greater effectiveness. The biggest ones all year was the Wolves were terrible in clutch time and have been awesome in this postseason, in that that really impacted my view of where the Wolves could go in the playoffs. I'm like, I watched this team blow game after game after game close in the fourth quarter during the regular season. So that impacted how far I thought they would go, because clutch time is like playoff basketball, right? But Ant hits another level. Julius started making more sense. Other guys have filtered into roles that fit them effectively for those times in the game. And now they look like a very different team. Like, this is not a sixth seed, you know? They were a sixth seed regular season team. And now I need to remember that this is just one of the best teams in the NBA right now. So maybe let go of some of those mental baggages or memories of what didn't work during the regular season, because largely it is working for this team. And so maybe that does give them a lot better of a chance against the Thunder than I would have said a month ago when I was thinking about the sixth seeded Timberwolves versus the 68 win Thunder. I don't know, man. I got to see it. Like, I want to see these games and see how they play against this Thunder team.
I think if I were power ranking the championship contenders, the final four teams there, who's most likely to win the NBA Finals, I would put it number one, Oklahoma City. Number two, Minnesota Timberwolves. Number three,
crazy,
Indiana Pacers. Number four, New York Knicks. Do you have any disagreements with that? In other words, I'm saying the finals winner comes out of the West.
I think it's close between the other three teams. Yeah, that's how I would put it. I might have the Knicks above the Pacers. But those three are all close, and the Wolves have a real opportunity here. I think they see that, they feel that, they believe that. These past couple of years in the postseason, man, it was like, let's get postseason experience. Like, it was weird being in the locker room after they won Game 5 against the Warriors and they moved on to the Western Conference Finals. Like, I saw more jubilation in there after like a win against the Hornets in February than I did after that. It was just kind of like, all right, yeah, no, this isn't it. Like, we're moving on. You know, we're ready for the Western Conference Finals. We're ready to finally be tested, because look, man, the Lakers nor the Warriors really gave the Wolves any problems in the postseason. And again, it's what I'm talking about. This is a better postseason team than it is a regular season team, and that's what I think we should be looking at here. Yeah, so I agree with you. They're the champions most likely coming out of the West.
I want to talk about the Nuggets. Obviously, just got eliminated for tonight from the postseason. What's next for them? Mm-hmm. Because look, man, Jokic is still the best player in the world, but Jamal Murray, you can flip a coin. And you're either going to get this dude's a Hall of Famer or this dude's a bum every single quarter with Jamal Murray. And tonight it was bum, 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 bum. Other games, the dude's unstoppable. There's literally nothing you can do about him. Feels like every 10 games he has an amazing performance, not as frequent as he once was. Michael Porter Jr. obviously has an injury this postseason, but he has his own limitations as well. Russell Westbrook, their free agent acquisition last year, a minus 92 in the series. Westbrook was absolutely horrible in this particular game. He's had a lot of rough moments throughout the series as well. I wonder what's next for Denver. I don't expect we're going to see, like, you know, some Shams bomb saying Jokic is going to meet with the team about their future or anything like that. But boy, like, they got to make some changes, I think, to get back to the mountaintop, Dane. What comes to mind for you, what Denver needs to change in order to take the next step once again in the playoffs?
Kevin, I feel like they need more players that have a bankable skill set. And I think, I know you can do the bum, 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 bum to Murray, and I know he struggled and he was hurt and there's injury factors to that. I have no problem with the Denver Nuggets starting five. I think you get them healthy, that's fine. I think the misstep was trying to round out your roster with young players that you do not know what they're going to be able to give you. And it would have just been really helpful in this series if, remember, like, Justin Holiday was on the team last year in the postseason, and not a great player, but like there's a 3-and-D catch and shoot guy, or just somebody who can space the floor for them effectively. When we're like, I don't know, I heard you and a lot of other people like, yo, Julian Strother after game 6. And I was like, man, if I'm the Oklahoma City Thunder, I say, I hope to God that you play Julian Strother for 20 minutes in the next game, because we're going to cook him.
He should have played more tonight after game 6.
I know, but it's indicative of a bigger problem when there aren't even like, there are not bankable things you can get out of anybody from their bench. The only bankable thing you get from anybody on their bench is chaos from Russ, which hits every so often. You know, I just think they put way too much stress on the main guys in that group. And it's just hard for me to rip on Porter Jr. right now, given what he was going through. But we also know the history there. Maybe that's a starting lineup lever that you pull. I just don't know how much that asset is going to get you or how far that's going to take you, given what his contract is. I don't know. I just think, generally speaking, this Denver Nuggets team was close to winning the championship this year. That's true. If what you just said was true about the Wolves having the second best odds, like, I think if they win that game today somehow, that I know they lost by 30, but if they somehow won that game, you have a healthy Gordon, whatever, I think the Nuggets probably, they're the favorites to win the championship. So what that says to me is, if you put competence around Nikola Jokic and he's as good as he was, then I see no reason why the Nuggets can't be a title contender again next season. And I'm not ready to go blow it up or even make some sort of aggressive, I don't know, maybe a Porter trade. That's the only thing I can really see there.
See, I think it's fair. I do think what you're saying is fair, especially in regards to, you know, Murray is sick. You know, and Porter has his injury right now. Of course, Gordon has the grade 2 hamstring strain as well. Like, they have injured guys, and they went to a game 7 against a 68-win team. Like, they had a great season. And the young guys,
they did that last year too, man. It was the same thing last year against the Wolves in the semifinals. Yeah. They're like, oh, we're too tired. Oh, we ran out of gas. Well, it's like, yeah, you have no players outside of your top 5. That's why they're injured.
Look, I mean, I think part of it, this goes back to the Kelvin Booth, Michael Malone thing and why they're both gone. Like, Malone didn't want to play young guys, and Booth drafted young guys hoping that they would receive an investment so they could be ready for moments like this. I tend to personally side with Booth in that Christian Brown was a huge draft hit. He was also one of the bright spots for Denver tonight in game 7 and throughout the series. He was a young guy who Michael Malone once was unwilling to play until Kelvin Booth traded away. Who did he trade that year? It's just slipping my mind at the moment.
KCP.
Bones Highland traded away Bones Highland that year midseason.
Wolves legend.
And yes, Wolves legend. He opened up minutes for Christian Brown. Malone was unwilling to play Hunter Tyson last year as a rookie, Julian Strother as a rookie, Peyton Watson as a young guy. He barely played him. Jalen Pickett as a rookie last year. He played 2-way guys last year, Malone did, over the actual draft picks that Booth drafted, because he didn't like Booth. Those guys butted heads. And so I think part of it is the young guys didn't receive the investment over the course of the full regular season that they should have, so they could, in theory, be ready for these moments. And part of it is the failing of Booth to surround this all-time great player with reliable players with bankable skills, to your point. I think it's both things for Denver with
Ryder. I think those picks stink. I thought those picks stunk. Like Hunter Tyson. Like, I mean, what are we talking about here? Like, these guys aren't. Well,
you're talking about Justin Holiday, Dane? Hey, Justin Holiday.
You watched Hunter Tyson. I'm saying a guy like that. You can't get a minimum contract. I mean, what are we. Like, there can't be a guy that could come in and play some normal rotation minutes for them. I mean, Pickett looks scared when he's out there. Strother can't guard anybody. Tyson. doesn't look to me like he can play very much. I mean, I get what you're saying, like in theory, like develop the young talent, but it's not like we haven't seen this young talent, man. Like maybe Watson, but like Watson
1 for 8 tonight. He sometimes, like sometimes he can score, sometimes he can't, and then other times it's like he can't.
It's a bad bench. It's a bad bench. They did that. There wasn't good picks. It's bad bench. It makes the starters tired every year. It makes the front office desperate to go get Russell Westbrook. It's like, I know it's reductive to be like, oh, it's the bench there, but I think it's just smarter for us to focus on that more so than it is to be like, Jamal Murray's a bum. I don't think Jamal Murray's a bum. And I think if you...
What I'm saying is, just to be clear, I'm saying one quarter, he's a Hall of Famer. One quarter, not so good. Like he is just so inconsistent.
Why?
And that leads to highs from him. I think with him, A, he enters every single season out of shape. That's just the reality. He enters the year out of shape. He's one of those guys that
I can't speak,
quote unquote, plays himself into shape over the course of the year. He's just one of those types of guys that leads to nagging injuries, as he had midway through last year, midway through this year. And I think it leads to him being a guy that just can't be trusted consistently. And he's always been this guy. He was like that when the Nuggets won the finals. He was like that last year when he had a game winner in what, Game 6 and 7 against the Lakers. He had a crappy game, finishes strong. Like so he's a playoff guy sometimes, but then I feel like it's just a little less frequently now. And so I think it's the bench. I don't think Murray is quite playing at his prime level anymore, as we saw the year the Nuggets won the NBA Finals. So I think it's both things. The question on my mind is, if it is something big, trading Porter, trading Murray, something dramatic, who would actually be the affordable guy you'd target here? Is it parts, like trading Porter Jr. into 3 pieces? Maybe that could make some sense. Who's going to do that for the price tag he has right now with his injury concerns? I don't really know who would be doing that.
I know the GM who gave him that contract.
Yes, you do. He's in Minnesota right now.
He likes to buy underappreciated assets. Just saying.
Now, what about, here's a big name for you. What about Kevin Durant? Go get KD from the Phoenix Suns. Pair him with Jokic. Trade either Murray or Porter. Salary fillers. Yeah, get diverted to a third team. Something.
Right.
Something big. Like, is KD a guy that you think Denver should go for?
Well, it's going to need to be a little bit more desperate than like a great fit or like a long-term play, given the money of Porter Jr. and Murray. Like, Murray's making 46 next year. Porter Jr.'s making 38. And both of those go long-term into the future. I mean, Jamal's making 58 in the 2028-2029 season. So you're in this position where, sure, we could be like, hey, let's have a meeting. We want to talk about trading Mike or Jamal. I just don't know how attractive that is going to be. I mean, the Jamal contract reminds me a lot of the Cat deal and the Wolves then getting off of that, because it wasn't that they didn't like him, but they needed to change. And so then because his contract was so bad, they had to trade him for another player with other issues. And Durant is different than that, but his issues are age and what comes with Kevin Durant. But yes, I think if they do trade Jamal Murray or Michael Porter Jr., it's going to be for a player maybe like KD, where you go, all right, this is a little bit of a risk, but I understand or getting off of a really intense contract in Murray or a really intense contract with Porter Jr. I think just so much of it starts with how much money those guys are making.
We're currently having all these talks about, what's Giannis going to do this offseason? Are the Bucks going to trade him? Should Giannis demand a trade? Why do you think that's never a conversation with Jokic in Denver?
That dude's different, man. He's just different. Like, he's the antithesis of all of these other stars in the way they carry themselves. I mean, he strikes me like Tim Duncan. You know, and there's just a value in home and an understanding of what it is. Now, I think the fair thing to bring up now is, you know, his pop is gone, right? Like Michael Malone's not there anymore. Tim Connelly isn't there in the front office anymore. Calvin Booth isn't. Does that like start to impact the foundation of comfort that Jokic has? I've just always thought if you can keep him comfortable enough, he's not going to leave, because that's just the, seems to be the type of guy he is, though. It's getting dicey. Yet at the same time, I think he understands that, you know, we were close to winning a championship this year. Give me a little bit better. Give me tweaks to this roster rather than get me off this roster. I feel like we're at that point more so, especially because it's him. I mean, we could talk about these contracts being bad. It's a hell of a lot of a better situation than the Milwaukee and Giannis salary cap situation and draft pick situation is, you know.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the Bucks have nothing. Nothing, really. It's an old team, not a lot of great support around him. It's just not a lot of hope there. Whereas with Denver, as we're talking about, they lose in the second round again. But they're probably the favorites if they had won the game. It's just the reality of it. They were close. They were close.
Yeah, you gotta hold on to some of that. And like, and Porter Jr., I mean, he's a frustrating player, man. I get it. Like, I'm not trying to be the guy that's like defending them, but sometimes you get in these spots with these players on these contracts, and we can say like, oh, they need to make a change. And sometimes the simple value of continuity, or I've learned in my career, the value of continuity in these teams is an undervalued thing, or I'm learning it now with what the Wolves have been doing recently. And something could feel uncomfortable, but also not, but changing it doesn't always have to be the, isn't always the best answer. I don't know. I guess that's where I'm at with this team. I have enough respect for Jokic and the rest of those guys that if you just give them a little bit of help and you are able to not play them all as much as they have to play, like, can we get a backup center? I'm so sick of the term non-Jokic minutes. We don't do that with like any other player in the league. Like, what the hell? You had Hartenstein. Like, well,
to be fair, again, another rookie here, so don't kill me here. The Nuggets did draft Daron Holmes last year, and then he ruptured his Achilles in the summer league. The hope was that he would be a five that would provide spacing, and again, a rookie. Maybe he would have stunk as a rookie and he wouldn't be getting minutes in the postseason and would have been irrelevant anyways. But that was the plan, at least, for Denver at the center position. But you're right. The non-Jokic minutes thing. That's talking
I'm like, about whenever I'm doing a game, I'm like annoyed to put it in my notes. I'm like, okay, nine. It's like today too. Like that was, I mean, you talked about that at the beginning. That was just so stupid. Why did, what was the start of the second quarter there? Why did they do that? It was no Jokic, no Murray. I don't know, that didn't make any sense to me. Also, right after Oklahoma City had just started figuring out at the end of the first quarter, yes. I feel for them. I know they can't figure it out. I don't know. It's a new coach. They can't figure it out. Maybe it just doesn't work. But it is kind of ridiculous that this is an issue and has been an issue for like 5 years now. Right.
I was. Overall unimpressed by Adelman this series. I thought he waited too long with Jokic to get him into motion and movement. Like, I mean, Jokic is a guy, is a 7 foot, 280 pound, whatever he weighs guy. We've seen him off of screens and movements off ball. Again, I'm slingshotting towards the basket. I didn't think we saw nearly enough of that midway through the series when OKC was defending him really effectively. So I was overall unimpressed with Adelman and some of the lineup decisions as well, especially as you said, start of the second quarter after OKC's figuring things out. You have no Jokic and no Murray. What the hell are you doing? It's just shocking.
And no Porter.
No Porter. Just insane decision there. A couple chat comments in here. Joseph said, Ant is going to prove he's the best G in the league. Dane, I do feel like Anthony Edwards this series against Oklahoma City, he gets through LeBron and Luka in the first round. He kind of gets through Steph, but he does get through the Warriors in the second round. I mean, not fully formed Warriors, but they'll still beat the Warriors.
Took care of
business. Took care of business. He did his job. He had some dominant moments. And then if he gets through a 68-win Oklahoma City Thunder team. Like, this is really an opportunity for Anthony Edwards, obviously for the Wolves as a team, but for Ant individually, just to skyrocket in star power if he gets through this run of teams in the West and then goes to a finals.
And he will deserve it if he does, because if they win this series, it will be because Anthony Edwards controlled the ball and controlled the pace of the Wolves offense the whole time. He will have overcome his issues with turning the ball over. He will overcome his offense. The Wolves offense will have overcome their issues of turning the ball over. They really struggled against the Warriors in that series. They turned the ball over 92 times in five games. That's ridiculous. And that was Ant's fault, you know? So if Ant is able to find a way to be the effective scorer, playmaker, and ball protector that he was in that Lakers series when the Wolves didn't turn it over more than 11 times in any of those games, then yes, Anthony Edwards will have overcome the things that those of us like myself that nitpick him all the time, he will overcome that, and he will have his team in the NBA Finals playing smart, effective basketball that he has not been known to have done for the first 4 or 5 years of his career. He's been a flash, lots of flashes in the pan over the course of the time. He often isn't consistent. And the times he has been against the Nuggets last year and against the Lakers in the first round of this first round series, those were not good defensive teams. This is a whole nother level of challenge for him to be kind of point Ant, lead the offense, and do it without letting them go on many of those turnover-fueled runs that that the Thunder, not due to every team in the league, including the Wolves. They did that to the Wolves this year as well. They did that to Ant as well. He has an opportunity, yeah, man, to not only be in the finals, but to have, like, overcome the few shortcomings that he even does have left in his game at 23 years old. I mean, as a nitpicker of Anthony Edwards, if he's able to get through this Oklahoma City defense, hat tip, man, you're one of the best players in the NBA. You know, like up there at that point.
Kevin McGovern, a.k.a. Kevin McWolf's hater, says in the chat, Thunder are going to run the Wolves off the court. There's a chance that happens. I don't think they're going to run them off the floor. We saw some warts with OKC this round against Denver, and Minnesota's got a hell of a defense. They got a hell of a best player in Anthony Edwards. They got a ton of different guys who can get scorching hot, whether it's Naz Reid or Julius Randle. I mean, McDaniels can have his moments as well. Gobert can have a 27-24 game, as we saw against Jackson Hayes. Like, I don't see that happening against Oklahoma City. Yeah. But I got a Gobert jersey over my shoulder. I have to mention Rudy.
Hey, he's important, though. He's important, too. If he can be an elite drop coverage center against an elite mid-range player in Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, man, that's going to make a world of a difference in this series. And Rudy has not been involved in the offense. And when he has, it's been fumbly through this postseason, but he hasn't really been involved very much. The 27-24 game you're referencing, well, that was game 5 of the Lakers series, and they blitzed Ant every single possession. So there you go. Roll down the middle of the floor, Rudy Gobert, and tuck yourself into the dunker spot. And if Anthony Edwards can find you, dunk, dunk, dunk. Like, that's what I'm saying. It's all Ant. Like, whatever these guys decide to throw, everybody else's job adjusts to how Ant handles that. You know, he has to put Julius in position. He has to put Jaden in position in the corner. Like, it's all, he is the sun, man. And they have to all orbit around that effectively, including Gobert. And I think a lot of people will sleep on Gobert in this series, and they'll probably sleep on him during the series, and they'll probably won't give him any credit after the fact when it's done. But if the Wolves win this series, it will be because their defense was just as good as the Thunder's defense was. And I don't know, man, show me a way that the Wolves defense can be as good as the Thunder's defense without the presence of Rudy Gobert. We all love Naz Reid. The Wolves defense gets a lot worse when Naz Reid moves into at the five than when Rudy's out there at the five.
Dane, do you have an early series prediction?
I mean, I think the Thunder should be favored for sure. And I think they deserve that. I think it would be, you know, disrespectful to not give them that. And frankly, they probably deserve less than seven games. You know, I know it's weird because the Wolves will be home for game six, but yeah, I'm not a big like pick it in the amount of games. I'm more of like a percent chance of winning the series. I think the Thunder have like probably a 65% chance of winning the series. I know sports books are even higher than that, but there's pathways here for the Wolves to give them problems too. We've been talking about this turnover stuff, talking all that, like the Thunder can't rebound, the Wolves can rebound. The Thunder can't really shoot threes, the Wolves can shoot threes. Like there's these other factors here too. There's more things that go in the Wolves' favor than not. They're just nerdy behind the scenes sort of stuff, or they're from players that people don't like Julius Randle and Rudy Gobert. You get a lot of those things to fall in line, and I don't think it's like out of the question that the Wolves could extend this to six or seven games. And if Ant is all world, then yeah, they got a chance, a 30% chance or whatever to win this. I guess I would say, though, if I had to pick, I think the fair thing to say is probably Thunder in six. But this is going to be a battle too. I'd be surprised if the Thunder run them off like the Mavericks ran them off the floor in last season's Western Conference Finals.
I think you're right.
What about you?
I'd go OKC in six, but I think it's going to be a battle. I mean, maybe we get a blowout, one or two blowouts, maybe just one in the series, but I think it's going to be a lot of close games. It wouldn't shock me if it's no blowouts at all. These are two great teams, two great defenses. They both have great best players on their teams, and you know, Jalen Williams and Julius Randle, these other guys who are capable of stepping up and having big performances as well. That's going to be where the difference lies. And as you said, Minnesota's shooting versus OKC's shooting and some of these other factors. I'd lean OKC, yeah, like 65, 70% or so. I think that's a good number you gave it, but I'm not discounting this Minnesota defense with Gobert and Anthony Edwards leading the offense. I think it'd be foolish.
You haven't even said Jaden's name, man. Jaden, yeah. McDaniels. Like, dude, he's as good as
one of the best perimeter defenders in the world. Yes.
Yeah. Like, that's going to be tough for Shea. Like, I mean, Shea's going to be fine, but you also got Nikhil coming in off the bench who can guard him and move with him. You could put Ant on him at times.
Like, Ant's a very good defender in his own right.
In isolation. And if that's,
sure, yeah,
you know, yes, what it is. But you know, I want to ask you, like, who wins between Jalen Williams and Julius Randle in this series? Like, are we, like, who wins the number two player? But I know that's reductive and that's like, we're on like First Take or whatever, but I do think that's, I think that's an important question in this series, given what we saw J-Dub struggle with at times in this series, not tonight, but earlier in the Denver series. And like, we got to give Julius some respect. It's not like he was doing what he did against bums. Like he was giving it to Jimmy Butler, Draymond Green. Like, I think that's probably closer in reality than most people think. Where are you at between those two?
I would give it to Julius Randle. What has Jalen Williams really done to give you any sense of confidence in him to be able to consistently do it? Whereas, as you just said, Julius Randle did it against Draymond Green. He did it against Jimmy Butler. Like, those guys are great defensive
LeBron
players.
James. And Grant,
exactly. He did it against LeBron in the first round. Randle has been tremendous this entire postseason. He has been consistent for the most part. He has brought it in some really tough matchups. And with OKC, it's going to have to be probably Jalen Williams or Lou Dort, like defending Randle in the chat. Jack said Chet maybe, or Dort. There's no clear answer. You think Caruso would be the guy defending Julius Randle?
Well, I mean, he's not going to start, so you know, you're going to have to start probably with J-Dub on Randle. But yeah, like, I think they have options of guys. Like, Julius sometimes, like, he could get his against, you know, like a smaller guy, and then you can, maybe if you switch a bigger guy onto him. Like, we saw that during the regular season. I respect to him. It didn't matter who guarded him. He gave him work last round. But, you know, I think if I'm Oklahoma City with both Ant as well, like, throw both of those guys different looks. I think just in confusion, you know, you might be able to generate some turnovers there. I was rewatching the first game between these two teams earlier in the season. They had Cason Wallace picking him up full court and stealing it, you know,
wow,
from him there. Like, there's a lot of, you know, they got a really good defensive team. But this Julius Randle that you just said is better than Jalen Williams, I don't know if I go that far, but it's close. It's at least close. Like, and if
performing
it's
performing better, it's better in a vacuum. Probably not.
Still playing defense.
Right now, offensively, sure. Yes, Jalen Williams still better defensively, but right now, offensively, Julius Randle has been better in the last month and a half. I think that's fair to say.
And last time I was on this podcast, me and you were hypothesizing ways to trade him for like Jabari Smith or something. We're like, that would be a good return. We were wrong. You were wrong
too. It's okay to be wrong and to change your mind. Dane, man, what a journey this year has been for the Timberwolves, and now to face off against the Thunder. I can't wait, man. Tuesday night. Appreciate you joining me today. Right, where can people find your stuff?
You can listen to the podcast wherever. It's on YouTube as well. We're recording like at the stadiums right after all the games. So we'll be recording right after game one in Oklahoma City on Tuesday night. And so you can kind of look for those first thing in the morning, right after every one of these games. It'll be myself and some of the other reporters who cover the team on my show kind of like cycle through. But yeah, you can find that wherever. And I think we're going to get you on at some point to,
hell yeah,
some point during the series to we'll see where we were right or wrong here. Yeah.
Anytime, Dane. I look forward to coming on. I appreciate you coming on my show today, man. Thank you so much for joining me, and thank you everybody for giving us a listen and a watch on YouTube. Give us a thumbs up, a like on YouTube if you're watching us live right now, and follow the podcast wherever you get your shows, on YouTube, on Yahoo Sports, or on the Kevin O'Connor Show page on Spotify, Apple, anywhere you get your podcasts. Thanks, and have a good night.